I'll start. As you see, I want to define the limits of what I'm talking about fiction. Fiction is not just everything that is not true, that is fictive. Fiction is not lies. It's not deception. It is not errors, mistakes. It is not delusion. It might be, with an answer frank here, illusion, because illusions can be quite useful. We are often presented with illusions for fun, like on the stage, on the film, virtual reality, all sorts of things. Illusion is quite useful because you can switch in and out of it, and we know it is an illusion. That's the point about fiction. We know it is fiction. It is overt, not covert. We can come back to that distinction later, but it's a very, very important distinction. The fiction gives us ways to understand. I shall use some key concepts in what I say today, but the way it gives us ways to understand is by giving us consistent and coherent patterns and examples. Now, one of the key concepts here is understanding. Understanding, in what I'm going to say today, is actually takes priority over truth. I'll come back to truth later. From factual examples, we induce patterns, making the distinction here between induction and deduction. Facts are realized states of affairs. And there is a difference that I want to emphasize again between facts and how the world works. This was a distinction that was not made clearly yesterday, because the way the world works, the way the world is includes past, present, future, includes possibilities. Facts, from the Latin factum, meaning done, are realized states of affairs. What has happened? Peter sat in that chair, was sitting in that chair. That is a fact. It is not, I submit, the way the world is. For understanding, the structure of these of theories, which is theories are about the way the world is, theories are illustrated by examples. Examples may be factual or fictional, hypothetical. For understanding, the structure of the theories must be consistent and coherent with their examples. So examples is also a key term I shall be using now to form a conceptual whole or conceptual web in the Aquinian sense. Fiction is ordered in the form of possible narrative. It is a model which aids understanding. The ordering of fiction, its form, aids understanding. It is usually in the form of cause and effect, although sometimes in certain kinds of literature they can play a bit fast and loose with that. But this is very important, that the form of fiction aids us to understand. It's presented to us already ordered, whereas facts are not. Facts are, in their raw form, and the way we get them from the world, random. Fiction presents the order to us. It uses Kantian categories, like cause and effect, embodies patterns, and exemplifies them. It uses induced explanatory theory and explicates it with examples. There's a difference here between explanation and explication. Explanation is usually in terms of cause and effect, relates a particular example to a more general pattern. Explication spreads it out for you to see, usually by means of examples. Being stripped of the extraneous contextual variables of fact, because each fact is in fact embedded
in a context on environment. And when the fact is stated, or put to us, or put into the form of a proposition, all that context is stripped out. But in fact, the fact, nevertheless, is embedded in context. Fiction is not. It serves as a model, therefore. Models are also stripped of context to aid understanding. Understanding comes from our ability to see a general pattern stripped of what you might call contingent, well, in classical philosophical terms, contingent context. This is especially true with something like cause and effect, where the caetus paribus clause is always kind of, oh, well, it's caetus paribus. Understanding, oh, where are we? That was possibilities. It enables us to create possibilities, therefore, because it gives us a form, a way to understand, as distinct from a recital of facts, a picture of facts, factum. It gives us, creates possibilities. What the author does is create possibilities which fit the model. That is the model which has been induced, the frame for understanding. They're only truly possible, and this is the way the word in true is introduced here, if the pattern is true. So we can apply a standard of truth to the pattern in that sense of the way the world is, but not in the sense, the factual sense of the way the world is. This is an axiom. A pattern is true to the extent that it repeats. To the extent that. That is, it doesn't entirely repeat or repeat exactly. It does repeat, but bits of it will be left out each time. It's contingent on context, contingent on time very much as well. I'm talking about patterns, by the way, in time, rather more than patterns in space, although the two are strongly related. It is not, therefore, a bivalent definition, because it is graded to the extent that. It's graded from naught to perfect, although neither, it wouldn't be called a pattern if it were naught, and it wouldn't, there is no such thing as a perfect repetition. And an example of a pattern is judged by exactly the same criteria. An example is also only an example if it is capable of repetition, or has been seen to be repeatable. Now, what happened there? Patterns are repetitions in time and space. They're very, very important, and it's a key concept as far as I'm concerned. Patterns are also known as regularities, natural law, things like that. But patterns enable types, as distinct from tokens. They therefore enable language. Language would not be possible if there were no patterns. Indeed, Heidegger had this famous question, why is there something rather than nothing? There is something because there are patterns. Because there is repetition. And reason. It enables us to think reasonably. Things like logic, metaphysics, all refer to patterns. They do not refer to tokens. They refer to types. Therefore, in that way, it enables understanding. You will see now why I'm trying to arrive at a different criterion than the ones that were put forward yesterday for truth. Understanding, in my thesis, is more important than truth. That's a pattern. It's a dendritic form. Dendritic meaning tree-like. It pops up all over our experience in time and in space. It's tree light because that's the way trees are. That is, that could be a fern form, it could be a frost form. It is dendritic. And it's a pattern both in time and space because they grow. You can see frost patterns growing on windows. In slow motion you could see plants and trees growing. But they are both temporal and spatial patterns. But they occur everywhere. They occur, I have a list here roughly, that's not the dendritic. Dendritic ones pop up in plants, crystals, rivers and estuaries, cooling systems, in our vascular system. That's a dendritic form. It's also our nervous system. Our brain has dendritic form. And it can be mathematically described and generated. It's both naturally occurring and efficient. Well, maybe that's mutually the reason for both being the case. Even without the help of evolution, it still can be efficient. Though evolution itself has dendritic form in time. As do my hands have dendritic form. I do, because I branch out from the center line. Branch. These are twigs. This is a branch. We have the ability to recognize, even from a very small part of a pattern, whenever it occurs. Another example of a pattern is nature is the bell-shaped curve. I haven't got an example of one, but they pop up in descriptions of all sorts of phenomena. Newton's laws are patterns in time. They're called laws, but they are patterns. Einstein's are perhaps patterns of time. I'll leave that with you. What matters here, though, is that the patterns in our timeline are in our timeline. Time is ours. We process time, if you like, or time processes us. So these patterns occur through us. As Anne said, separation world us is stupid because we are part of the world. And if we weren't, there'd be certainly no philosophy. Sign systems, language, cannot exist without patterns. Neither, arguably, could thought itself. What fiction does is to exemplify patterns as in facts. But each fact and fiction do it differently. This thing about language, sign systems. You cannot have a sign for something which is not part of a pattern. A sign for a single instance is a contradiction in terms. The difference between science and fiction is very different. They are very different, but they are complementary. Science moves from facts, from factum, from facti, to patterns. It is context-free. It is theoretically context-free, because you have to strip out the context in order to create the theories, the models. Fiction moves from patterns, not necessarily explicit patterns, but patterns we all understand, know about, to possible examples. Once you have a pattern, you have a possibility, by the way. It is contextualized. Authors, writers of fiction, put in the context. I see some puzzled frowns. Perhaps we can have the questions later. They are two different contracts. Whereas science is based in a contract between scientists to test and critique each other's work so that it can form a corporate, ideally objective, this is where objectivity would come in, view. Fiction is based on a different contract, and that between writer and reader. Both forms of contract are cyclic, there's feedback reaction. they constantly modify and reform each other. But the writers and readers of fiction are not usually interested in objectivity, unless they're members of the Nouvelle Roman school. They're interested in what it feels like to be each other, which opens up quite another kind of possibility, one of alternative subjectivities. That's one of the things that fiction introduces into our understanding of the world, what it feels like to be someone else. Somebody was talking about empathy yesterday, I can't remember who, but this is where it comes in fiction. Between them, I suggest, science and fiction open up our world and free us from the channels of dogma. Science, because it is a democracy of inquiry, and fiction, because it is overtly not the truth. There are always alternative fictions. Like the illusion, you can pop in and out of them as you wish, and that's very important in fiction. Instead, they offer the possibility of insight, truthful, vraisemblable insight. Vraisemblable is an important idea here. It's not exactly translatable into English, because in English it has a kind of pejorative feel, seeming like the truth, appearing like the truth. Verisimilitude is the nearest I can get to it, but in French it was actually used by Corneille as a standard for the truth of fiction, of his plays. If a thing is vraisemblable, if it has verisimilitude, we can believe it. We can adopt it as a profitable and useful illusion. We can take it in and drop it. Fiction, I'm sound it saying, stands in relation to fact as experiment does to science, and thought experiment does to philosophy. It explores the possible and tests it for what? Truthfulness, verisimilitude. Metaphysically, it stands in relation to what is, the noumenon, exactly as we do. Again, that's important. Science does not, but fiction does. We are more like the readers and writers of fiction than we are like the scientist. Judging what is possible from what we have learned. What we learn is patterns, by the way. We don't learn we do learn facts if we belong. If we go to the wrong kind of school, we learn an awful lot of facts. But what are useful to us are patterns, ways to understand. So in what ways, in what sense is science true? Authors are very keen on truth. They aim for it. And they do it by telling stories. Marilynne Robinson says, she's a very important, very good American author, "Why is it possible to speak of fiction as true or false? I have no idea. But if a time comes when I seem not to be making the distinction with some degree of reliability, I hope someone will let me know." Authors are engaged, I would say, with imagining for us a truth about the possibly possible, what is truly possible. We find within overt fiction itself the most penetrating analyses of deception and illusion. Delusion. Overt fiction is covert fiction's severest critic and enemy. Shakespeare hates deceivers. In Othello, Hamlet, Macbeth, Lear, and even the comedies, his villains are the dissemblers, the deceivers, those who pretend. As Hamlet said, "'Tis meet I set it down, but a man may smile and be a villain." And Iago says, "I am not what I am." Shakespeare is also constantly concerned with the nature of illusion, as in the prologue to Henry V, when he talks about the stage and the theatre, or the Midsummer Night's Dream, or Hamlet again. He talks about that this player here, what's Hecuba to him or he to Hecuba, because the player can show real emotion, can weep. Real emotion. Whereas Hamlet can't. Hamlet's father was killed, but Hamlet has no emotion. He's numb. The player can play it. And there is the famous speech, "All the world's a stage." Hamlet's fascinated by this illusion of reality. The Tempest plays with illusions and delusions, as does the Dream. His contemporary Calderon in Spain wrote the famous play, "Life's a Dream." Don Quixote is the classic victim of delusion at the same period in history. Delusion. Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina are victims of their personal fictions. Ibsen gives us other examples. In each case, delusion is destructive. Illusion is instructive. So, in less drastic ways, were Jane Austen's Bennet family. They were deluded about the truth that is universally accepted. In the game of Let's Pretend, the truth will out. The play is the thing wherein to catch the conscience of the king. No, I shouldn't have done that. About storytelling. We have an appetite for stories of many kinds, stories that give form to our lives and the world. But many of the most famous are fictions, myths and legends, parables and fables. Interestingly, in making a general point, we often prefer the false example to the true one. For example, Putnam's famous Twin Earth, a fable, or Mary's Room, not Putnam, not time, that's also a fable. They're far better, in fact. They couldn't make the same point with real examples, because real examples of their thesis do not exist. That's crazy, isn't it? Myths and fables. Marilyn Robinson said, "Greek and Roman boys memorized Homer. This was a large part of their education, just as memorizing the Quran is now for many boys in Islamic cultures. Narrative always implies cause and consequence. It creates paradigmatic structures around which experience can be ordered, and this certainly would account for the craving for it, which might well be called a need." The Greek and Romans and Islamic boys were reading stories that were as factual to them as the New Testament is for a Bible Belt fundamentalist today. Undermine those paradigmatic structures and you undermine their ability to understand. They've become lost in the world. We don't know now how those myths were perceived, whether they were seen as true or false, or just ways of understanding, or indeed, if they cared, did they distinguish between truth and falsity in the way we now do? There is a difference, though. When we're taught physics, this is where that comes in, we are invited to picture the atom as a structure of little balls, particles. We're told that they are hugely out of proportion, that if the particles were really that size, the model would fill the Albert Hall, and that they spin and whirl in constant motion. But that model is not the truth. It is just an illustration that offers an imperfect way of understanding, one of many possible ways. When a Greek boy was told about Eros, little god of love, did he actually think that a winged cherub would shoot an arrow into his heart? I doubt it. Do we believe that in that model of the atom? Do we believe in it? Do we think it's true? Or that the universe is infinite and time had a beginning? If we believe that, either we have to adjust our idea of time or beginning. And if we can do that, what can we do with the idea of causation? If our modern idea of truth is shot through with contradictions like that, and some of the those we saw yesterday, what should we hang on to? I submit that what we do is find ways to understand, and ways to understand how we understand, which is the job of philosophy. That's why we're here today. Homer is somewhere between history, fiction, and myth. That's Achilles. I think he's the one with the helmet on, which isn't fair at all. In a world whose whims of weather and chance were little understood, it made sense to give them superhuman faces and minds, to see storms as caused by Neptune and the sun as Phoebus' cart. But did those boys see the stories as true or just a way of seeing? Do we? For most people on Earth, religions and ideology conflate the two, way of seeing and truth. History becomes the frame of understanding. The tenets of the religions of the book are founded in story. The story, both in the book and of the book, how the book originated. Stories are the basis of other world religions too, carved in stone in jungles and deserts. We learn the stories before we learn to believe. First the story, then the moral imperative. The story gives a form of understanding or misunderstanding. It's also patriotism stems from history. The history of this island is the basis of the kind of patriotism that Gove wants to instill into our children. The possible. I've said how I think the possible becomes true. Understanding wakes us up, above all, to what is beyond immediate fact. It lets in the possible, which is a lot more interesting. It frees us up to new perspectives. What happens in fiction is just what could happen, because it offers us a pattern to take home, one we want to take home. Why do we want this? Because, I suggest, it offers us an alternative reality, an option. It is wrong to call this an escape. It is, on the contrary, a new tool in our locker. We recognize fellows up there in the fiction. People like ourselves, though often from another time and place, once upon a time in a land far, far away. We learn from them. We learn about from their mistakes, their mistakes. We need lots of mistakes. Mistakes are terribly important to us. Because the only way we can learn is by making mistakes. And if we can pick up a book and find out about other people's mistakes, gosh, what a wonderful, quick, harmless, economical way of learning. We are in the story as we might be in another kind of role, moving from parent to teacher to job. But these other things are more real and therefore constraining. At the same time, the fiction presents us with a limited set of possibilities. It is a predictable environment where we feel safe. The story has shape and continuity, a framework of expectations. It has to be consistent. It has to be coherent. Fiction has internal logic, although they may not be the logic of our world. I mean, the logic of fantasy is not necessarily the logic of our world, but it is nevertheless a logic. Incidentally, there is absolutely no reason, as far as I can see, why logic should have anything to do with our world at all. I'm sure we could construct infinite logics which have absolutely nothing to do with the way our world works. While we are inside that frame of understanding, what happens is the truth. This is truth as coherence, as non-contradiction, as concordance, harmony, and fit. These are ideas that our ancestors thought very important to understanding the cosmos, Pythagoras, for example, or Confucius. Fiction gives us new ways of seeing. It offers tokens, that is, examples. It does not itself establish a theory or set of types. On the contrary, good fiction fleshes out, adds context to its exemplary characters and makes them real, as complex and environmentally bogged down as we are. And it, therefore they are imaginable. We can imagine the people in fiction better than we can imagine the elements in a theory. We can't imagine what particles are like unless we have a model on which to pin our imagination. Most people read fiction in order to confirm their worldview. How am I going for time? Oh, I've gone over.
Questions.
Yes, I know. Okay, I'm going to just say that it gives us new ways of seeing that certain authors give us completely new worlds, like Kafka or Dostoevsky. They give us new worlds which we are led into, even Dickens. They give us worlds which we can wrap around us for a while and then take off. They help us to understand by taking us into those new worlds. Now, over versus covert fictions. Covert fictions present a narrative to account for origins, history, mystery, and moral compulsions. They are the tools of ideology, all ideologies. They are actually the tools of dictators and authoritarian regimes. They create a fiction which people then think is true, are made to think is true. If they doubt it, they're sent to prison or psychiatric wards. And covert fictions are dangerous, but overt fictions are useful. It's a very important distinction that we know the difference. The difference between delusion and illusion. Typically, covert fictions present narratives to account for where we are at the moment and what we're doing at the moment, but they're false narratives. It's notable that Puritans and fundamentalists of all persuasions seek to eliminate fictions. They eliminate play, even music or plays, as frivolous, even dangerous alternatives to their truth, to the one truth. Finally, falsification. Falsification. In fiction, we judge as false what appears insincere, and that's a Bernard Williams word for he uses as a criterion of, for truth. If they are falsely motivated, i.e. they seem to come from the wrong motive, they're trying to push an agenda onto us, we distrust them. If they're falsely mediated, i.e. by clumsy style, cliché-ridden repetition, then we distrust them. And if they do not relate to our patterns of experience, our patterns of experience, not an individual experience, our patterns of experience, if they relate to that, if we can match in some way the patterns we have experienced and learned with the patterns we see in the fiction, then they help us, give us ways of understanding. And finally, Terry Pratchett, who died recently, as you may know, he said, fantasy can't get you anywhere, but it tones up the muscles that can. Okay. Oops, there's a spotlight there. Oh, it's there.
Format
while they're putting out the lights, so they're upright.
So
I'll
put
up your hand if you don't have questions, and then I'll go around.
Yes, I agree with you. I think fictions are like thought experiments, and exploring possibilities. And fiction keeps some of the world fixed and changes other bits of the world. And it strikes me that modern fiction, the modern novel, really is about looking at human beings as we understand them, but putting them in unusual situations. So somebody who may have been Thomas Hardy, I think, said that novels were about putting real people in maybe unlikely situations. And I think that we can accept all sorts of maybe impossibilities in fiction like time travel, but the thing that makes us think, well, that's not true, is that if you think, well, that person wouldn't behave like that. Mm.
Yeah.
So that we expect, but I wonder whether this is specific to our modern ideas of literature and the novel, which has an emphasis on people's internal life and motivation. And I think fiction can serve other purposes, but is the novel, is modern fiction, basically about human psychology? It's about understanding human motivation, why we act, and it's our way of exploring issues of, yeah, motivation and psychology. It's thought experiments in that area.
I absolutely agree. I have nothing to disagree with. I've expanded a bit and I say that I also think that classical mythology was about human psychology as well. I mean, the gods, Venus and the gods of power, the gods of war, all those were ways of doing a kind of analysis of human psychology and putting them out there. I mean, what's the difference between Freud's ego, superego, and id, and the Greek gods? They're just invented at different times and places for actually very similar purposes. Yes.
Peter, I enjoyed this presentation very much indeed. Particularly, I liked your phrase alternative subjectivities, which you used near the beginning. It made me think of how little you tell anybody about a pillar box when you say it's red. You show it, they discover far more about the pillar box if you can show it to them, or if you can find ways of helping them to see the pillar box for themselves. You used the phrase new ways of seeing too. I remember when I wanted to find out a bit more about the Spanish Civil War and read Homage to Catalonia, which is a factual account of Orwell's experience. But then I went on to read For Whom the Bell Tolls, and at the end of that, I knew more about the Spanish Civil War than I had after reading Orwell, because there was a description of how people felt in a fictional context that brought the whole experience closer to my own subjectivity. I thought this was a very useful way of describing the importance of fiction. I heard a guy on the radio recently emphasize the importance of those bits of fiction that come to be universally believed. And his prime example was money. That's a story that everybody believes. What it says on your £10 note about the Bank of England promising to deliver £10 sterling at one level it's fiction, at another level, when everybody believes it, it comes to be true.
I was saying actually, yes, I think in fact alternative subjectivities are one way of arriving at objectivity. In other words, the more subjectivities we can collect, the more objective we can become. The other thing is that there is a maxim in fiction, especially in playwriting, don't tell, show. And I think that's part of what you said just now.
So we just have just one question,
if
we can deal with it very
quickly. Well, thanks. I'll try and be quick. I'm bothered by this blurring of fiction and stories and patterns. Myths are stories, and it's still a question how far they are true and how far they are fiction. It seems to me fiction has a different purpose. It is to enable imaginative, intuitive empathy with the way it felt to be somebody who didn't exist, but anyway. So it's not psychology in the sense of a manageable generalization. It's an intuitive sense that the fiction is convincing or unconvincing. That seems to me the essence.
Yes, that's true. That, in that sense, the novel is very different from mythology. in the sense that mythology could be taken as to be true, and in fact maybe the
Romans did think it was true. And maybe they didn't think too much about it. But as ways of understanding, whereas mythology, like Freudian psychology, has this formal aspect, it stitches things up and puts them back together again. Fiction, modern fiction does not do that. Modern fiction is holistic in the sense that it concentrates on alternative subjectivities. But in the sense, mythology, classical mythology, well, all mythology, is analytic. It strips out the forces in the world and the forces in the mind, and then recombines them into story. Whereas, I think if modern fiction did that, you would dismiss it as formulaic, actually. You'd say, this man has just put in these people as symbols, and therefore I don't believe it. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference in sensibilities across the centuries.
Thank you. I'm sorry, we don't have time for any more questions.